Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. Our series revolving around the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing continues with a pair of interviews with two producers of video content that have only one thing really in common, Apollo 11. Later on in the show, we'll talk to UK YouTuber Simon Plumpton. He's produced an incredibly accurate recreation of the entire Apollo 11 mission from liftoff to splashdown using archival sound loops recorded both in the spacecraft and in Mission Control in Houston. But first, we have a special conversation with Australian filmmaker Rob Sitch. If I could make one suggestion to you for a great way to have a family night celebrating the Apollo 11 mission on July 20th, 50 years after the moon landing, I'd recommend you get the movie The Dish on DVD, gather around your best screen, bust out the popcorn, and have a good old-fashioned movie night. It's a wonderful film that's funny, touching, and family-friendly with only mild language issues to watch out for. It's also mostly true. It's the story of a group of radio astronomers based at the Parkes Radio Telescope in the Australian outback small town of the same name. The main characters, played by Sam Neill, who you probably know as Dr. Grant from Jurassic Park, Patrick Warburton, who's been on Seinfeld, played the Tick, and Lemony Snicket in A Series of Unfortunate Events, as well as his ubiquitous national car rental commercials, plus Australian actors Tom Long and Kevin Harrington are charged with making sure the Parkes Radio Telescope, also known as The Dish, which is the largest of its kind in the Southern Hemisphere, brings back the voice communications, telemetry, and most dramatically, the TV coverage of the moonwalk as Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin take those first steps on the moon at Tranquility Base. Power outages, windstorms ensue to try and foil their mission, but spoiler alert, we do get to watch the moonwalk. It's also an amazing piece of cultural anthropology as we witness the mission through the eyes of the small-town residents of Parkes that find themselves smack dab in the middle of the greatest adventure of all time. It's warm, funny, and touching. I reached out to the director and co-writer of the 2000 Working Dog Productions film, Rob Sitch, and he graciously agreed to join us from his office in Melbourne, Australia. I started out our conversation by telling Rob that The Dish is my second favorite movie of all time.
I'm wounded, Dave. What's the first?
Well, my favorite film is Casablanca, and I just an hour ago figured out, you know, what the deal is with The Dish. It's because I have the American DVD release from Warner Brothers, and it always starts out with As Time Goes By and then goes into The Dish. So, you know, I think that's part of it.
I absolutely love Casablanca. When you're an Australian, you spend a lot of time on long-haul flights, and sometimes the latest CGI-driven blockbuster doesn't interest, and I'll go into the classics and play my 10 favorite scenes from Casablanca as a reminder of how well made it was.
I love that film, and that's why I love The Dish. And we'll talk about, you know, setting the film up for everybody in just a moment, but I love it because, like Casablanca, it's story and character-driven. It doesn't need special effects. It doesn't need anything but a great story. And that's why I love this film. Can you get us started with you as a director? How did you get interested in film?
I actually had my heart set on becoming a fighter pilot as a student. My father was in the RAAF, the Royal Australian Air Force, during World War II, and served alongside a lot of Americans. And that was my dream. And at the age of 15, I did a eyesight test, and the fellow said, "Did you know you were colorblind?" And I said, "I didn't, but will that stop me joining the RAAF?" And he said, "As what?" And I said, "A fighter pilot." And he said, "No chance in the world." So I recalibrated my plans, and I was doing medicine, and a friend of mine said, "Why don't we try out for a play?" And at the age of 21, I entered the arts through comedy, of course, and then we made lots of television, and then we sort of progressed there to make films. And we literally sat down one day, the first time we ever sat down to think of film ideas, my co-writer, Tom Gleisner, said after, I think one of us came up with, we were going to make about a bad circus and that didn't fly. And then he said, do you know anything about Australia's involvement in the Apollo 11 program? And our jaws dropped because I'd never heard it mentioned once, and I was an Apollo program nerd, and we went back to the newspapers, and in actual fact, for the weeks after, you know, they landed in 69, the newspapers had quite a few articles on it, and then it just disappeared.
So that was the genesis of the dish, was the idea, because I'm really curious about that, about how you guys landed on telling the story of Apollo 11 through the radio telescope at Parkes. Can you just tell us a little bit about how did you decide to do that as a major film for you?
I think the Apollo program would, you know, you can look at it from a million different angles, but there was one thing being incredibly isolated, and I was old enough to remember it, and sat in a classroom as the live television pictures came in. I don't think anything in my life matches the sense of wonder that you felt on the other side of the world. You know, the 60s was, you look at cars from that period and you can't believe, they weren't very reliable. You can't believe anyone got to the moon. And every time you picked up a book about it or looked at the photos of it, that sense of wonder flooded back. And in some ways, it occurred to us that we lived in the most unlikely country in the world to have had anything to do with that incredible program, and that sense of wonder could be best told from a little dot on the other side of the world.
Tell us about how you decided on telling the story through Parkes and the radio telescope there.
Well, the radio telescope is impossibly large when you go and visit it. And it was, I think it was built in the 50s when there was the age of discovery of, you know, the early days of radio astronomy. And when NASA went around the world trying to link up quite a substantial network of relay stations. I think they even had a relay ship in the middle of the Pacific. And television was kind of a late decision in the Apollo program, or to do it at the level that they did it. And so there wasn't a lot of time to get prepared for it, but radio astronomy in a way had it covered. And so they were able to go around the world and link up this network. And when we found out about the story, we started digging into it, and it became more and more sort of, in a humorous way, more and more incredible, because that radio telescope really is out in the middle of a sheep paddock. And the photos of all these highly qualified radio astronomers, in a way, they walked around in shorts and what seemed little flip-flops, and it was a lovely contrast. And so just even looking at the photos at the time just gave us a great deal of amusement. It was the greatest achievement in the history of mankind, but against this backdrop of quite an outback regional look.
You know, I tell my friends in the space history community all the time, and we're all connecting together. For example, yesterday we interviewed Fred Hayes, who was one of the backup crew members for Apollo 11. He was the last person to be in the Columbia command module, setting all the switches before Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins got in there. And it was a joy to talk to him. But when I talk to all of my friends who are in the space buff community, because we're all, you know, just gearing up for this, and I've been doing a series of programs on all of the Apollo missions 50 years later, and, you know, now you're part of our look at Apollo 11. But I asked them, I said, have you seen the dish? And I get one of two reactions. One is like, oh, yes, I love that film. Or it's like, no, I've never seen that. And I just tell them, I said, I'm so glad you've never seen it, because I want you to watch it and you're in for a total treat.
You know, the funny thing is, I probably, like you, am absolutely in awe of what was done at the time. And it's sort of nice to do something, have some connection with the program, albeit by, you know, by making a comedy film. But when we first set out to make the film, we were intending to make it much sillier and, you know, not to the point of Caddyshack or something like that. But what happened is that in the research, the program kind of, the tail wagged the dog in a way. We kept getting affected by going back and reimagining that time, that feeling. And so one of the hardest things, or the thing that we all spent so long on and in making it I was conscious of, is people would often say to me, you know, how are you going to make that film? Everyone knows the ending. And I said, that's not what film does best. Film, it's not about this film won't be about the ending. It'll be about recreating the feeling. And that's what we spent months and months in the edit room and the planning, recreating that incredible moment when, you know, television in this country was still black and white. And people had a front row seat, again, to the greatest achievement of peacetime in mankind's history. And it was that sense of absolute awe and wonder that hit people like a ton of bricks as the events unfolded.
Rob, can you tell us about the casting? Because you have such a wonderful cast in this film, especially Sam Neill as the lead astronomer, the dishmaster, as he's put, Cliff. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, how you got Sam Neill, who's such a wonderful actor that our listeners all know from his role in Jurassic Park as Alan Grant, the paleontologist?
Yeah. So I'd met Sam through completely, I'm a very keen fly fisherman and so I go to New Zealand quite a bit and we sort of cross paths on that of all things. But Sam, if you think Australians are laconic, you should go to New Zealand because it doesn't matter how high you rise in New Zealand's society, you can't have what we call tickets on yourself. And so Sam in real life is just a wonderfully humble and easygoing man. And we made contact with him and I flew up to Sydney and he has a house there and met him in his backyard. And I sort of thought I'd have to do this big long pitch and he said yes within a couple of minutes, which I didn't hear. So I went on and on. And after about an hour, he sort of turned to me and said, I said yes about an hour ago. So he was so he was fantastic. Patrick Warburton we saw in Seinfeld, and he played a character called Putty, and we went that he just did it in such a special way. And we often say that comedians, you know, will often find drama easier than comedy, and so we touched base with him on that case. Another guy, there was four in the main control room, and another gentleman called Harrington, turned out that he and I, it was like a reunion, didn't realise that we went to the same primary school and sat in the same classroom watching the television as man landed on the moon.
And he plays Mitch, right, who's one of the technical guys that works
yeah,
there.
Kevin Harrington.
Wonderful. Yeah. Very, very funny.
And then he was in a lovely Australian drama here called Sea Change, and with the other gentleman called Tom Long, and so they just worked so well together. So we approached them both, and so in that sense, it was more straightforward than, you know, casting is often a nightmare, but for us it was one of the easiest things we did.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with movie director Rob Sitch. His 2000 indie film, The Dish, is a warm and humorous look at the Apollo 11 mission, as experienced by the astronomers and townspeople involved with the Parkes Radio Telescope in Australia's outback. I'm Dave Schloem, and you are listening to Blue Dot.
Thank you.
Let's continue now as we talk to director Rob Sitch. He joined us from Australia to talk about his 2000 film, The Dish. It tells the story of a team of radio astronomers tasked with bringing the signal of the Apollo 11 moonwalk down from Tranquility Base and into living rooms around the world on July 20th, 1969. You know, the town of Parks, one of the things that's great about this movie is it makes you feel like you're in this small town, and you capture the flavor and character of the town. The town really becomes, and all of the people in it become, you know, really main characters in this. Tell us a bit about, for our American listeners here, tell us a bit about Parks, Australia.
So it's about 4 hours' drive due west from Sydney. It's part of a pretty substantial agricultural area, grains and sheep and cattle. And so we had to, Parks strangely had become quite successful because it's at the crossroads of a railway. And so a lot of modern buildings had taken over the old charm. So we went about 20 miles down the road and had to mock up another local town of to look like Parks. It was a part of Australia sort of 150 years ago that had a huge gold rush. And Australia had a curiously wild, wild west back then, a lot of bush rangers, a lot of outlaws. And I think one of the biggest gold robberies in history went out that way. They had to get the carriages across these vast lands carrying huge amounts of gold. And so it was sort of originally famous for what we call bushrangers or outlaws there, but now it's very much a mix of agricultural, regional, and of course this amazing radio telescope that's still used to this day.
When I tell friends of mine about your film, it's always a little difficult to describe it to them to get them into like, yeah, you want to watch this. And I'm wondering what it was like for you pitching this film to get it financed. Because when people ask me, well, what's it about? It's like, it's about a radio telescope that brings back the pictures from Apollo 11. And, you know, that's not something that sounds like, oh, wow, got to see that.
Yeah, not one to get the kids in. So we were aware of that at the time, but we thought it was back. It was back at a time when you could have word of mouth and that you could market a film without CGI. But it was a pretty nervous time, and we had a pretty rocky path to it. But I think always at the back end, we thought it might be an advantage to start in this sort of with this backdrop of bucolic charm, and then end up watching man land on the moon, and that final 15 minutes would be almost like a warm shock to the system. And so we sort of, that was at the back of our heads, we always thought that would be sort of a winning formula or enough of a winning formula to get an audience.
Well, obviously this is a film, it's a dramatic comedy film, not a documentary. What are some of the big liberties you took in telling this story? Because, you know, the story of bringing the pictures back and the Apollo 11 radio telemetry, it's more complicated than one radio telescope and three guys working it.
That's right. There was a big contingent, including NASA and Australian technicians at the OTC Centre in Sydney. Again, I was saying there was that ship out in the Pacific. Australia had multiple radio telescope facilities. There was a series of dishes at a place called Honeysuckle Creek, which grabbed the pictures and when we came to it, I mean, on one front we said, let's not bury the lead. Basically, we can say that every picture from the moon came out of Australia, and that was our starting point. And then there's a tussle over who had this, which picture, and we asked NASA and they wouldn't adjudicate. But I think that the first pictures came from Honeysuckle Creek, and all the higher end pictures for the next hour and a half, I think, came out of Parks, even though Parks was receiving it. But even as I'm saying that, as a filmmaker, your head's spinning because you're saying, hang on, can we just condense the fact into that it all came out of Australia? And it's funny, I used to spend so long worrying about the details. I sat down and I got the complete transcript of Mission Control to Apollo 11 and went through the 7 days of the transcript, because you sort of get addicted to adding details. As I say, we started with a comedy and then we just kept adding details. But it's funny, there's the three big dishes of the world from memory were Goldstone in California, Madrid and Parks in Australia. And to condense the drama, to communicate the drama, we decided early on, look, we'll make it the two dishes, Goldstone and Parks. And when the film was released in Spain, I thought I was going to get in trouble for that liberty. And I did a range of interviews, and not including the local Madrid newspaper, and not one person raised it with me. But about maybe 6 months, a year after it was shown in America, we got an incredibly gracious letter from Neil Armstrong, who sort of warmly congratulated us on the film and finished with, although I don't know how those people in Madrid will feel about you.
Wow. You know, the engineer in Neil, and he was such a fair-minded person. I can see him doing that.
Isn't it amazing? As in the only person, his attention to detail was so huge. He couldn't let that liberty go through, but even he had a sense of perspective.
And it's not just that with Neil. He was also just, he recognized what a massive team effort it was, and always wanted, you know, everyone who played a part in the Apollo program to be recognized. That was, I know from a fact from talking to his biographer, James Hansen, that was always of paramount importance to him.
Yeah, and it's that speaks to another bit we weren't going to originally put in the film, but an example of how the program kind of affected us more than we're affecting the story. That one of the things we loved in the film is that of the dish listening in at night to the communications between the modules and Mission Control, and that sense of telemetry. I think, you know, these days we're used to 42 cameras feeding into a LED screen the size of a barn door in our house, but there's something beautiful and almost about that analog world of radio signals, listening in as they undocked in preparation for the descent. And that poetic, and Neil Armstrong managed to be very poetic over the journey. They rogered his undocking and he said, "The eagle has wings." And he thought, it's just one of the most economically beautiful statements, magnified by the fact that it was said from deep space. It's a beautiful thing to say.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, that gives me goosebumps just thinking about the way you described that, because that is an iconic moment from the mission. Let's talk about the funny stuff, okay?
Well, we...
because it's a funny movie. My favorite moment, I want to know how you came upon this, was the American National Anthem at the little ball get-together with the American ambassador there. And they play a very interesting rendition of the Star Spangled Banner.
They do. We it's funny. We sat down and worked out what was going on in 1969. It was a wonderful year for music, and it was also an interesting year for television. Hawaii Five-O with Steve McGarrett was out and about at the time. And so early on, I think we had a different song in mind. So, you know, spoiler alert for anyone who was intending to see it, but... Australia has sort of proudly welcomed a series of US ambassadors. It's fair to say they're not the career diplomat. They're often the donor to the winning party. And they're often very, very distinguished, tall, grey-haired, successful businessmen. And we, John McMartin, this wonderful American actor, flew out to play this part, and we had him in the hall. And as a sort of an honour to him, the school band had prearranged to sing the national anthem, but got their wires crossed and played the theme from Hawaii Five-O.
It's hilarious. That what I love is just watching the reaction of Patrick Warburton and him, you know, just as they look at each other, like, how are we supposed to react to this? We don't want to insult these people, but this is awkward. It's so funny.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's funny when you live in this part of the world because, you know, it's a mix of countries down this way, and getting the wrong national anthem is a bit of a habit of the South Pacific. So it happens in real life too.
Ah, well, you mentioned the music, and one of the things that really is fun for anybody of my age that remembers Apollo 11, because, you know, we were around in the 1960s, the music of the 1960s is just laced throughout this film so wonderfully. Tell us a bit about how you picked out the music to play on your soundtrack.
It was incredible, Dave, because 69 just threw up great song after great song after great song, and songs that have sat and with us for a very long time. And it was at a time when people experimented with lots of different instruments, you know, the theremin with Beach Boys in the 60s, and that was a bit of a habit of the 60s, I think. But classical gas was 69. Australia probably, there was a song called The Real Thing, which we used in the opening titles. And that was a young performer by the name of Russell Morris recorded it. And it was one of those times when people didn't know they were making mistakes. They were trying to innovate and do interesting things. And it was a young guy and a young producer throwing tons of sounds in there, and that song still tops a lot of people's charts in Australia for the favourite song ever made by this country. There's a meaning there, but the meaning there doesn't really mean a thing. Come and see the real thing, come and see the real thing, come and see. I am the real thing. We had that kind of backup at the time. We used a whole bunch of really good songs, and then there was another 20 we didn't get to use. But we always realised that we were going to have an orchestral score, and that meant, getting in a composer and getting in a symphony orchestra. And that's one of the most interesting experiences I've ever had, because we got the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, 100-plus piece orchestra, and the American composer flew out for it. Boy by the name of Ed Choi, very, very talented. And I thought it was going to be like putting down a sort of an Elton John album. It was going to take a couple of weeks. But the conductor walked in, everyone had their sheet music in front of them, and it was starting at 9. He tapped the baton at 9, and at 9:01, they did the first take, they did the second take, and then moved on. And maybe it took 6 hours, and every take was perfect.
Wow. And it really brings, there's some of the music, the majesty of that giant dish as it slowly rotates into position. You know, the dish itself becomes such an iconic character in the film, and the music helps with that. That when Classical Gas by Mason Williams plays, that's absolutely one of my favorite parts of the film. I've always loved that piece of music, but seeing that huge radio telescope slowly turn into position to pick up Apollo 11 with it is just perfect.
And it's sort of, it is symphonic. It's symphonic and majestic. And I had our designer create a scale model with electric motors of the dish. It took weeks and weeks, and was able to put a lamp in the place where the sun would be and plan all of those shots meticulously. Australia is blessed by some beautiful weather, but one thing we have is a brutal sunshine. And we shot the dish during the winter solstice. Have I got that right? The bottom? And so the sun rays at that time were at their lowest that they get in Australia, and even still it looks like summer. So I had to sort of spend a lot of time plotting and planning what time of day and even where to put the helicopter to get those shots. It's funny, when we had access to the dish, we had a fellow beside us who was connected to someone in the control room, and one day we were losing light. And a very frustrating thing on a film set. And then a penny dropped in my brain and I went, I've got the biggest bounce board that's ever been built in the history of cinematography. So we got the dish to engage, tip around and reflect three stops of light onto the set. And so we're able to keep shooting for another hour.
Wow. Yeah. You know, you brought up another point, you know, when you mentioned that is that one of the things I also, you know, it occurs to me watching the film is this all takes place in July of 1969, which is summer in America. You know, I'm talking to you in the evening, just as we go into summer here in California. You are talking to me at, what, 11 o'clock-ish in the morning in Australia, and you are headed into the opposite. You're headed into winter. So the Apollo 11 mission for the people at Parks in Australia is happening in the wintertime. And, you know, that's kind of a cool thing when I watch that in the movie is it gives you that sense of we live on a planet with two hemispheres.
Yes, you know, no, it is. It's an amazing thing. One of the things being old enough to remember that time, I look back and can't believe how squashed the program was. You know, that Apollo 10 went up only a few months before, 9, 8. It was a very dense period for everyone involved.
Yeah, because, you know, Apollo 10, the dress rehearsal was in May, and then bam, July is the landing.
It's absolutely incredible. And what was nice is in researching the film, as I say, we thought we were, you know, we're going to end up something just to the left of Caddyshack. But the program and the details and the photos and the vision and the recordings were so affecting that we kept getting to scenes where we had something silly up our sleeve and we were able to just shift it into almost pure drama at times.
What I think my favorite character in the film has got to be Glenn Latham, played by Tom Long. And, he reminds me of a character we have in the United States who just retired from his role on The Big Bang Theory, Sheldon. And I tell people, you know, about this film, it's like he's a lot like Sheldon, only he's a sweet, kind person instead of a jerk.
So Tom Long was a superb actor, and that's the other thing. I think there are certain things you see in life as an adult that can't get any more sort of heart crushing and sweet, and that is when two people are incredibly attracted to each other, and don't know that the other is as attracted as they are, and then adults have to intercede to kind of just push and prod them. And so, you know, I often laugh. I think these days to get any impact, you have to fly onto the screen nude and hop into a bed within 1 minute. But in actual fact, I mean, there's no adult on this planet who doesn't remember that feeling, that awkward feeling somewhere between 16 and 21 when, you know, we've all gone through it. And we had a lot of fun bringing that to life.
And that's, you know, the magic of making film when you do it right is the characters in the film, all of them, and the town, and of course the beautiful radio telescope, it all feels so real. And of course it's based on a real story, but the characters as you bring them to life in the film, they feel so real to me that, you know, after watching this movie many, many times, you know, I forget that these are fictional characters and they're not real. They seem real. And one of my favorite characters is me. I'm in the film.
Right. Yeah. No. Yeah. No. The young boy sitting and watching. It's a. Yeah. I'm guessing that's you. Yeah.
That's me. And when I watch that and I see that little boy talking to his dad, who's kind of clueless about the technical aspects of, you know, going to the moon, and he's trying to explain it to his father, who's, you know, oh yeah, hydrogen. That was me in 1969. There's kind of a story that goes around my family, and I don't know if it's really true or not, but they tell it, is that on the tour bus at the Kennedy Space Center when I was 7 years old, I kept correcting the tour bus driver about facts, you know, pertaining to the space program. And finally he said, why don't we just let this little guy do the tour? And, you know, I don't really remember that, but my sister says, oh yeah, you did.
That just sounds so believable, because I just remember just about every model at the time was of a Saturn V rocket. The number of toys that were Apollo based at the time, and it was the level of detail in the newspapers and in magazines was absolutely huge. And it's we have a sense of amazement now of what was achieved. You know, for anyone who's younger than us, imagine the sense of incredulity we had at the time. You just couldn't quite believe that they were going to pull it off.
Gosh, so there's even that moment where it's in your film where the little boy Billy says, you know, guidance is internal. He knows what's coming next. And then,
yeah,
boom, the liftoff. And I love watching, you know, this is the other thing is, you see in your film, you show the people watching the television and their expressions on their faces and the wonder of watching this happen unfolding before you. And that's what that time capsule of, it really feels like you're back in 1969. And small town Australia felt very similar to me to small town California.
And it was incredible to everybody at the time because, you know, satellite TV, Australia had to, I mean, we only got television here because we hosted the 56 Olympics and it was a requirement to host the Olympics. Even when, you know, we got live Elvis live from Hawaii once, 10 years later, it was still incredible. But I don't think we all believed we were going to be able to watch it. You know, television hadn't yet become the absolute force in world events that it was today. There were still, you know, people film movie reels and ship them out. And that's one thing I remember being in it was during school time and classes were called off and we were all brought into two or three televisions they had arranged. And that's what one of the clear memories I have is that no one moved.
Well, we've got to let you go, but one thought occurred to me is there's a moment in the film where there's a reporter, I think he's a newspaper reporter, at the very beginning of the film, interviewing the staff members of the dish, the three main characters there at the control room, and they're asking the American character, Patrick Warburton, you know, about how he's finding his stay in Australia. And he starts to say the people are warm. And he doesn't even get warm out before the reporter says, warm and friendly. Yeah, we get it. He's heard it before. But what I love about this film is it's warm and friendly.
Yeah. And isn't that how most of us get along? You know, I think everything I read about and did, you know, we did a lot of research for it. What came out was just the level of professionalism and professional mutual respect that was conducted through the whole program.
Well, Rob Sitch, I want to thank you for joining us on Blue Dot, and I really want to thank you for making my second favorite film of all time.
Dave, it's an absolute pleasure, and I may well represent the least qualified member of the Apollo program to be on your program.
You are listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. Thanks to our guest, Australian filmmaker Rob Sitch. His 2000 movie, The Dish, stars Sam Neill and Patrick Warburton, and it's available on DVD. When we come back, we'll talk to YouTuber Simon Plumpton, who's created a full mission recreation of Apollo 11 that features archived audio and state-of-the-art computer animations coupled with the original TV broadcasts. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Our next guest is Simon Plumpton. His YouTube channel, called Lunar Module 5, features recreations of early NASA space missions. Simon Plumpton, welcome to Blue Dot.
Oh, thank you very much, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing great, and we are getting ready for the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, Apollo 11, and I was talking to you about, I think, a month or so ago, 2 months, and you told me about an incredible project you have. So lay it on our listeners. What do you got coming for us here in July?
So about 2 years ago, we had a look at whether it was possible to put the whole of the Apollo 11 flight together with all the audio and the video and the pictures and anything else we could find. We do full mission videos on YouTube, and I wanted to try a different format. So we've tried a whole day in one video, and those are ready to release in July.
And what will the first video be?
The first one's released on the 5th of July. That's the pre-mission press conference, just to get us started.
Yeah, and then so does the main course come on July 16th?
The main course comes on July 16th, and then there's a video released every single day, right the way through to July 24th. And then the final one is in August, which is the post-mission press conference.
Okay, well, for our listeners, one of the things, because I listened to and watched the Apollo 10 full mission series that you did, it was very helpful for me preparing for my interviews with the Apollo 10 astronaut, Tom Stafford, and Jerry Griffin, who was one of the flight controllers, and I was able to listen to all of the mission audio and follow along from launch to splashdown. It was wonderful, wonderful experience. And I'm wondering if you could explain to our listeners, as you watch this, you know, unfold through a whole day, what are you seeing on the screen most of the time, and what are you hearing?
Well, I think the major thing to say is that the audio is going to be sometimes in three track, one in the middle of your nose and your eyes, and one in your left ear and one in your right ear, because there are flight director loops. There's the air to ground audio. And sometimes there's the middle audio, which is the flight crew are talking, and that's being recorded on board. So it was a very interesting process putting all that together and syncing it all up, because sometimes they're not quite the same speed recording. So it took a while, probably a few weeks on each video to do that. So that's the thing you'll be hearing. So if we go to the launch day, you'll hear the obviously the PAO, so that's Jack Riley talking.
Jack King, right?
Oh, sorry, Jack King, yeah. There we go. Too much space shuttle.
That's okay.
Yeah, so Jack King's talking in one ear, and in the other ear you'll hear the loop, which was recorded from Mission Control in Houston, which has also underneath got the launch control audio. So you can hear both of those loops talking at the same time, right the way through to liftoff. And then from liftoff, you'll hear the normal loop that you heard on the air to ground and the flight director loop from Houston. And that carries on sort of, that's the kind of thing that you're going to hear. Visually, of course, there is limited video. There is only the video that was broadcast or the films that are available. In between all those, I use Space Simulator to show what was happening outside the spacecraft, looking at the spacecraft, at the orientation it was at, and things that were going on, burns and things like that. So you get something to watch while you're listening to all this stuff going on. And then added to that is every single photograph that was taken is added in. And I tried to put them in at the timeline. I got a lot of help from a lovely guy called Robin, who told me the timelines, and then trying to fit them in into the timelines was the goal of that part of the day, as it were. So that's what people will see.
Well, and you were telling me that with the Space Simulator software, the animation, you've really taken great pains to have the spacecraft exactly in the orientation it's in, you know, relative to the Earth and the Moon. Everything is really, you know, happening as it was. You're experiencing Apollo 11 from lift off to splashdown if you want. You can do the whole mission. And I find that just amazing to think of, about that experience that people can have.
Yeah, and I think that when I did Apollo 10, which is way, way back in time, I didn't have that knowledge, I had the ability to do that if I'd looked into it, but I just wanted to show the burns in any way I could and the orientation. But this time we've tried to go for what the orientation of the spacecraft was, how it would have looked to a degree, as much as we could. So Robin and I worked really, really hard to try and, I kept sending him test videos. Did it look like this? And he would come back with, you need to orientate it slightly differently. So we went away and did some more recording and finally got to where we've got to. Sometimes it's easy to work that out because the film the crew took, when it stops, you can just tell what the orientation was when they stopped filming. So it's very easy to carry on. But most of the time you're day two, into halfway between the moon and the earth, and you've got to know the precise way it's going to be for the next mid-course correction and how that burn looked from the outside. Of course, nobody ever saw the burn. No, there were no cameras, but that was how it would have looked. Hopefully we got it right.
Well, kind of, because I know some amateur astronomer friends of mine and I, we actually watched some of those burns through our telescopes. You could just see, a little dot in the sky. So, it wasn't that great, but you could see, oh yeah, that's Apollo 11 on the way to the moon.
Well, at least you saw the burns happening. You're probably the only guys who actually did, I should think. Yeah.
There were a lot of us doing that. And it's one of those things I always point out to those people that don't believe we went to the moon. It's like, well, hey, we watched them when they fired the rockets. It was pretty cool.
Fantastic.
When did your interest in this begin? Because you've been at this quite a while now.
It was 2013. I did the Apollo 13 launch with visuals from the simulator. And somebody on the site, on the channel, just said, why don't you do, I think it was in jest, why don't you do the whole mission? And I kind of took that as a challenge and thought, well, okay, why don't I do the whole mission? So I did 13 first. So that was 6 years ago. So we've been doing it for 6 years.
And what are the resources you use to get the audio for this?
There's the NASA Audio Archive, which is the main repository for everything. The only issue with it is that once you've downloaded the audio that they have on it, which is fantastic. I mean, for any space enthusiast, go and get it because it's free. You can download it. You can listen to it. The only issue for me is that I've got to edit every single moment of that audio because I want to take out the gaps that are there. I don't want the gaps in. So there can be gaps of up to 30 minutes sometimes between spacecraft communication. And I take those out so that the videos aren't, otherwise you'd be listening to static for 30 minutes sometimes. So that's the only issue I have with the audio. I've got to edit every single second and make sure I don't take something out that's supposed to be in there. That was the rule in my head. Don't delete something somebody said.
Experiencing the entire mission like you have and listening to all of this audio, you are now a foremost expert on the Apollo 11 mission. Was there a couple things you discovered, little tidbits that you found that were like, wow, I never knew that, or something really interesting you could share with us?
I think first of all, the onboard tapes tell you something. It tells you something about the crew and the way that they work together. And I found that really interesting. You can tell in the inflection and the way that they talk to each other, which you don't get from the air to ground because it's very businesslike on the air to ground. Whereas they're just talking about, getting breakfast ready, and those tapes are included in the series. I think the most interesting stuff has been around listening to the flight director loops. There's one occasion specifically where a flight director calls home, and that's included. I'm not going to tell you which one that's on so people will listen, but he calls home and says he's going to be back for some dinner. And it's like a moment in time. This great thing is happening. This amazing mission is happening. And yet, I'm going to go home for lunch in a minute. and see my family. And also, he also wants some film for Apollo 8, which obviously he's ordered. And he calls the company, and the company's not sure they can get it. And later on in the mission, that same flight director also calls a flag company to make sure they've got enough flags in mission control for the splashdown.
Oh, wow.
So it's stuff like that which you listen to and you think, it's really interesting. I've never heard that before, never heard those conversations before.
Best of luck with this. Looking back on it now that you're basically done, was it worth it?
Yeah, it was. I'm really, really pleased with it. I can't wait. It's been the longest time now for the last 2 months wanting to release it. And I could have released it. I could have said, okay, we'll do it in May or June. But I just thought that I'll wait. I said July. I'm going to keep with July. So I'm just ready for that week. And hopefully we have some fun with it and see what people think.
Well, I'll definitely be listening. It's a fun way to experience the mission, and especially, like you said, all those intimate moments. And I'm looking forward to listening to Armstrong and Aldrin and Collins talk about their breakfast. And hey, which one of you is going to go use the urinary facilities next? You know, I got to go. Hurry up, Neil.
You'll have fun with that, Dave.
All right. Well, Simon Plumpton, thanks so much for joining us, and best of luck with your YouTube channel, Lunar Module 5, and the Apollo 11 full mission.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for the time on the phone, and have a good day.
Thanks, Simon. Check out Simon Plumpton's YouTube channel, Lunar Module 5, and follow Apollo 11 from liftoff to splashdown. Thanks once again to our first guest, director Rob Sitch. His 2000 film, The Dish, is available on DVD. Blue Dot is produced by North State Public Radio. We're distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. You can check out this and share past episodes at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to us. Our podcast is on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. Our assistant producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.